Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
You pray with me, O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Dear friends, letter that I wrote yesterday just to keep you updated. Dear friends, I wish to wish you a very prosperous new year, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically, and materially. The way that the divine life force, or prana, has been coursing through this form has made me very indrawn at this time. It has been a fascinating and challenging as the flow of prana has been opening new channels within the spine and brain. This is not a vague experience, but a powerful movement that can be traced through precise channels of the brain and spine. This commanding flow does not allow for many ordinary activities to occur, and that in itself is an interesting study, how I can focus on a few external things and not be able to attend to many others. When we have had devotees stay at the house or I've had been scheduled to travel, the movement of this force is modified, and I can generally carry on in an outwardly normal way. However, these are small windows of time, and as soon as I return to this Dharmashala, our home, where the devotees leave, I instantly become immersed in this experience once again. Through grace, I am sustained, and I can continue on in this body. I remind God that I am but a small instrument, and He is very powerful. He responds that all such ideas of large and small are false notions, and that total surrender is what is in order. And I feel this way, totally surrendered to His will. And yet a part of the mind feels badly that I'm not able to respond to much of the mail that has piled up through this time. So I'd like to assure each of you that it's not lack of wanting to keep up with these replies, but divine will is not allowed for it at this time. It is clear to me why many yogis and mystics have needed seclusion during part or all of their lives. I feel the greatest privilege and gratitude to those who have had faith in this work and who have so steadfastly given financial support. It allows not only for me to complete this inner work, but also the many plans we have for publishing, etc. Divine Mind has assured me this work is a help to many. We live in a time when we have ample proof in the financial markets that we do not individually and collectively, that what we do individually and collectively have definite results. This truth should be axiomatic, self-evident. What each one does matters. And yet so many make decisions as if they live in a vacuum, that they can do and say things that are clearly adharmic, not correct, and pretend that it is all right. The repercussion of this type of living is predictable: failure, chaos, and painful lessons. Decisions made through selfishness, greed, arrogance, and need for fame will spell out ultimate failure each and every time. On the other side of that ego coin are decisions made out of fear. But, as Swami Satchitananda's wonderful prayer goes, who is to blame is not important. Only, how shall we set the situation right? These outer circumstances remind us to get our own house in order, to set our own affairs up so that we are confident that we may stand before God and all and be willing to submit our lives to the light of wisdom without reservation. With all love and joy, David.
get these wonderful little stories about Anande Mama from a wonderful disciple of hers. And this is a story about Atmananda, a disciple of Anande Mama's, walking with Ma. While walking, Ma picked up a bougainvillea twig and commented to me, "How beautiful. Look, the leaves are garua, the color worn by Hindu ascetics." "In my country, all leaves become garua in autumn," I remarked. "In your country," said Mataji, "which is your country?" "Where I used to be before I came to India." "Before?" questioned Ma. "What does it mean? And before that, where were you?" "With you." "With me? How do you know?" "You know." "How do you know that I know?" "I don't know." "How do you know that you don't know?" "I don't know anything. I'm a fool." "How do you know that you are a fool?" "Now I have to become silent. And what is the use of this silence? Idle talk and nonsense will remain unsaid. And to what good? I don't know." Mataji, "You don't know?" Again you repeat that you don't know. Has one who does not know anything the right to become angry? One who knows gets angry because this or that should not be as it should. But a fool should not be angry since he does not know how things should be. Always remember that you are a fool and that therefore you cannot become angry. It is the I that gets angry, and it is the I that has to be dropped. The fool, Buddha, may perhaps become enlightened, Buddha. Anyway, bear in mind that you know nothing, and therefore there is no rhyme or reason in getting angry. Then the I will go, and Atmananda, meaning the bliss of the self, as well as her name, may become revealed. Mataji handed the bougainvillea twig to me and said, "Pluck all the petals that are garu and dry them and keep them. The dried flowers are still with me, but they have lost their beautiful color." And from the book, Death Must Die, "It is difficult for those living in the world," this is Anande Mama speaking, "it is difficult for those living in the world to always find time to sit down for prayers. It is also difficult to always cultivate the company of saints or to attend religious meetings. But it is easy and always possible to keep company with God in the shape of His name or the mantra received from the Guru. One cannot always have an image or a picture of a deity in front of one's eyes, but the image of God as Akshara, the indestructible divine sound inherent in the mantra, can be one's constant companion under all circumstances. By constant practice, one finally achieves the goal. Everyone should think, 'All right, our friend,'" Ma referring to herself, "has shown us the way. We shall try to follow her advice to the minutest detail. At what moment his touch will be felt lies with him. Our duty is to continue to invoke him in all times. Enough time already has been spent in going here and there aimlessly, leaving the path in order to enjoy the sights of the world and to have fun in various ways in the manner of the world. Ages and ages have been wasted in this way. Now, as much time as possible should be dedicated to attempt to find oneself. Now, my friend, return to your home. By lingering on the way, you only prolong the agony of having to endure the troubles and difficulties that are met with on the pilgrimage. Ever remember that one who tries to advance him and practices his name, his presence, progresses whatever his condition may be. To say, 'I am not feeling his response,' and therefore to seek pleasure in mundane things can never be beneficial. Ever bear this in mind. While the person who lives in the world takes pleasure in parties, meeting people, etc., the one who is out for self-realization will take pleasure in meditation, singing the praises of God, reading the books of wisdom, listening to discourses by great souls, and mixing with those who are pilgrims on the path. The devotee who will come to feel that he is the servant of the Lord and therefore become humble, gentle, sweet. Everyone, whatever his line of approach, should become gentle, kind, loving, for the self is one. Those wonderful words. And from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, coming from chapter 2, verse 33. But if thou declinest to undertake this righteous combat, then having relinquished thine own dharma and glory, thou wilt reap sin. That's the quote from the Gita and Master's commentary. If you refuse the opportunity to fight and conquer the enemies that are threatening your welfare and inner kingdom of true happiness, you will have shirked your righteous duty and sullied the honor of your true self, a sin against the divine image in which you are made. The beauty of the Gita is the universality of its teachings, applicable to all phases of life. This stanza instructs the businessman, for instance, that when he enters the spiritual path, he must not become indolent, unpractical, or foolish in his ordinary worldly affairs, forgetting to protect righteously his interests against unscrupulous competitors. He can practice unselfishness without neglecting his own necessary interests. A businessman who, through foolhardiness and false spirituality, declines to fight a righteous battle, business battle, will surely lose the glory and the success befitting his position. By his neglect of business laws, he invites the state or sin of uncalled for losses and failures. Nor should a businessman rob Peter to pay Paul, that is, make money dishonestly in order to use it for philanthropic purposes. One should earn his living honestly and should fight all crafty business competition that tries to paralyze him. It is possible to be unselfish and non-attached to possessions without supinely permitting others to trample on one's rights. A spiritual businessman who allows the unethical persons to crowd him out of existence is guilty of tolerating injustice and thus of permitting evil practices to spread in the business world. In short, nearly every good businessman must be, in modern competitive life, an embattled warrior. The moral man, who tries to subjugate the seemingly uncontrollable proclivities of the senses, so trains them that they rejoice in his true happiness and not rebel against it. The self-controlled moral individual does not give quarter to any temptation that militates against the pure nature and true happiness of the soul. Sense-controlled is applied to a man who is a slave of his senses. The self-controlled devotee is one who is governed and disciplined by the wisdom of the self. The more an individual becomes sense-controlled, the less he is self-controlled. He who has tasted the happiness of a self-controlled life automatically resists the inordinate temptations of the senses. He is a deserter who does not want to battle the wicked cravings of the conscious or subconscious mind. He loses honor and virtue and the joy of self-control. Ultimately, he falls into the sinful or sorrow-making pit of uncontrolled existence. Just as an automobile with a broken steering rod becomes a runaway from its proper path and falls into a ditch by the roadside, so a man with a broken self-control falls into the pit of inner disquietude. To avoid the miserable state of a moral derelict, everyone should protect himself against the invaders of false temptations, those that promise happiness but impart misery. Many a moralist encounters an inner psychological battle when companions tempt him to digress from the straight and narrow path of morality. Confronted by unscrupulous individuals with blunt consciences and poor spiritual judgment, the true moralist should redouble his mental determination to travel in the path of contentment, continuously fighting any temptation that waylays him to prevent his teaching reaching the destination of happiness. Similarly, any husband or wife who forgets to protect the happiness of a moral life together will certainly plunge into that relationship into the pit of disharmony and complex sufferings. One's self-controlled happiness must be staunchly guarded against the attacks of the wandering hordes of visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatorial, and tactual sensations. Even though entrenched by self-control, one must constantly be on the watch for the sudden guerrilla warfare tactics of sense temptations. The mental or moral strength of man becomes successively stronger by valiantly battling every trial and temptation. The law of life offers man the balance of resistance in his God-given will and immortal soul qualities. It is his duty to bring out this hidden strength, this divine heritage, and prove himself a worthy son of God. And it is a sin against soul progress for a man to lay down his arms of will and self-control and acknowledge defeat when challenged by any kind of trial. I'd like to speak to you this morning again about life's trials. We are born into this world, and almost from the very beginning, we suffer various pangs. We have the pangs of hunger and separation from the mother initially. The pang of birth itself is something that is of a battle that we, as a child coming into this world, have to squeeze through such a small opening in order to come out, and that it's a battle just to be even to be born. And mother and child have to struggle together, and the mother, it is said, goes into the very jaws of death in order to bring out life. Now, this can be very dispiriting to us because we wish for peace, we wish for happiness, we wish for ease of life. And yet, this battle of life that we have been enjoined upon is something that we must grapple with in some way. I remember that for so long, I felt an inner resentment, a deep resentment, that life should be easier, I thought in my own mind. Things should come easier. Grades should come easier. Friends should come easier. Money should come easier. Success should come easier. Everything should be easier. And this I had, even though there were various successes that came to me along the way. And I realized at some point that I carried this resentment with me, this resistance about life and the nature of life. I think for many of us, we have come from higher astral planes and causal planes, where life indeed is much easier, certainly in terms of movement, of health, of being able to meet the requirements for food and that kind of thing. It all came much easier from the places where we came from. And I have memories of these kinds of lifetimes and what it was like. Not only that, but we were differentiated from other people who were at odds with our own kind of thinking, that in the astral realms and the causal realms even more, people are divided into various states according to their natures. And so you don't have somebody who's terribly bent on hurting and destroying other people mixing with those who are of a higher consciousness. So coming into this world can be a rather shocking kind of experience. And we don't like it. We'd prefer it to be some other way. And oftentimes this is the reason why people have running arguments with God, is because they feel that somehow life has shortchanged them. If God designed this life, as he's the progenitor of everything that is, then why is it so difficult? Why do we have these stark contrasts in our life? Why do we have, perhaps, someone who loves us very much and somebody else who conceives a hatred for us and who tries to plague our lives and tries to destroy us? I remember having a person in my professional life who decided, and I never knew the reason why, that she wanted to destroy this life, to professionally, in any way that she could. She conceived a hatred. I represented something to her, I think, because there's nothing in our interactions that would have warranted any kind of attitude like that. And so she would think day and night and through the weekend, according to people, mutual acquaintances that we had, that she was out to destroy me. And it was a very odd sensation to think of somebody having such a hatred for you and actively wanting to destroy you. And she made up things. She distributed lies around that I had stolen money and embezzled money and that I had mistreated clients and all the rest of it. And it was really something. And but for the grace of God that I had a very strong, dynamic supervisor who was completely in my support and would go after these lies, and every time they are proven to be false. And yet, because she had friends in high places, she was able to survive in that job for many years. And so these things happen. These things happen. And worse things than that, of course. And we suffer as a result. But the biggest reason for our suffering is because we hold in an idea that life should be different than what it is. Arjuna stands upon the battlefield, and he is a timeless archetype for what all of us in our ego sense have. He represents the will. He's the third chakra. And he invites Krishna, who represents divine will, the sixth chakra, to be his charioteer, to be his driver, to help him to maneuver through this war. But he looks out and he looks across and he sees all the opposition on the other side. And he just wants to give up. He just wants to give it all in. He wants to retire from the battlefield and he wants to go off to a cave to meditate. But he was born to be a warrior. He was born to be on that battlefield. And do you think that he could retire from that battlefield, knowing that his brothers and his relatives and his teachers are all engaging in this battle, and be able to have any peace of mind at all? And of course he could not. He would be worried, he would be agitated, he would be feeling that he had abdicated a role that he was born to play. And all of us in our lives have a role to play in the realm of Dharma, of supporting what is right, what is good in this world. Now, it does not mean we need to be a busybody and get into everybody's business and give everyone advice all the time. That's not at all. But there are those times, whether we're in business or in an organization, whether we're in a family, whatever the circumstances are, that there is clearly something inside of us tells us that this is adharmic. This is not correct, what was going on. And that we are called upon to stand up. We are called upon to have a voice. We are called upon to take some actions. And we may want to just retire from the field. We may not want to confront whatever it is that has to be corrected. And yet if we do not, as Arjuna is told by Krishna, not only will his reputation suffer, his own individual reputation, because he does not do what he is called upon to do, but the world at large will suffer. Now, these may seem like small things when we are encountering them. And yet, when we look at the internal resistance we feel around it, we feel a great resistance to entering into it. It doesn't feel small at all to us. And so we have to stand forward and speak the truth. And all of us are called upon to do this. As I say, it does not mean we need to be proselytizers, putting our foot into doors and going in where we are not bidden to go. But there are those times and circumstances when we all need to stand up for what is true and what is right. I remember when Mother first asked me to start giving talks, and I had led a very private life in terms of my spiritual life before that time. And not only had she asked me to give talks, but she also asked me to speak from my own experience. And this was a difficult thing for me to do. I had, because of my own internal psyche and my external conditions, I had learned to become a very inward person. It was part of my nature, but also there were things that in life made it dangerous to express too much of myself. And I responded, rather than by fighting and becoming an extrovert about it, I became internalized. and introverted. And so Mother was asking me to reverse that trend, to stand up before God and anyone who would listen, and tell them what my internal and external experiences were all about in relationship to the spiritual path. These were her instructions to me. And so I have done the best that I could in this regard. And it was not easy, as I say in the beginning. I had to challenge myself. I had to allow some of the deepest, most profound experiences, things that could be easily misinterpreted, misunderstood, or ridiculed by others, and bring them out into the open. And now I feel a freedom that I did not feel at that time. I would hope and think that whatever I have done in this life, and I am not proud of everything that I have done, not everything that I have done has been correct or right, and I have made many mistakes along the way. But I think that I could stand before God and anyone else and be an open book in that regard. And that whatever mistakes that I have made in this lifetime, that I have learned from those mistakes, and that I have moved on. And all of us are in that same boat when we are sincere and when we are honest. We have to be able to approach ourselves with that unstinting honesty. We have to be able to level with ourselves if there's no one else. And when we take a look at our lives and we sum it up, we look at what we really have expended and who we have expended it for in this life. And have we fulfilled the dream that we have set out for ourselves? All of us, every soul who comes into this world with a plan. And in that plan, we want to achieve certain things. Now, for some individuals, it may be gaining a certain kind of balance. It may be successful in business. It may be achieving particular goals of education or family or children or other kinds of things. And these are all good and noble things in their own time. But there comes a time in each soul when we aspire for something higher, when we want to grow, and it may be an unspoken kind of thought or desire inside of us. We can't quite put our finger on it, but we know that there's something greater residing inside of us. We know that there is spiritual growth to be had. Now, we may not know what that is exactly, but we feel it. And within that feeling, we reach out and we find a resonance in the spiritual teachings. We find that something is growing in us. And then we make that aspiration to reach for something higher. But you know what? All of the tendencies of the mind and the desire natures begin to grab out for us and begin to limit us. And this is the crucifixion. This is the way of the cross. When you think of your spine as being the upward member, the vertical member of the cross, and it is through this spine that the life energy is rising up. Each stage of the spine or the cross represents a different state of consciousness. Each one of the disciples within the story of the Bible represents a different aspect of this cross, of this spinal system. And so as we aspire upwards, the horizontal or the limiting nature of the human or of the world begins to have a cross-sectional with it. And we have a fight on our hands. It can be as simple as dedicating ourselves to telling the truth. But then telling the truth may put us into a bad light, or it may expose us to some ridicule or even some penalty of some kind. And so then we really feel a battle. Do I want to tell the truth, or do I want to just go with this little white lie, this little omission, that if I didn't say it, then I wouldn't be in such bad trouble? And these are the small kinds of temptations that come along on this way of the cross. And if we ascend higher It delves deeper into the subconscious mind. It goes into those great fears inside of us. The biggest fear, I think, that is universal in mankind is fear of death, ultimately. And we fear the death because it is the great unknown. And any time that we're ready to let go of our present-day life and move into a higher realm and sphere, it is a kind of death because we don't know for certain what we're going to experience on the other side. Will I lose all sense of control? Will I be able to survive? Will I be happy? Will I have fulfillment? We don't know any of these things before we go out. We're like the babe who's in the womb, who's not yet born. What is it going to be like on the other side? We don't know what that's going to be like. And we know that there's a certain comfort level we've had within the womb, but it's also we're outgrowing it. And we know that we cannot remain there for long. And so the movement to go out begins to proceed. Each one of us does that in a different kind of a way when we move from one stage of consciousness to another. And just like with physical birth, there are the pangs of birth that go along with it. And there's the stress. And there's the difficulties. And we feel it inside of us. It incorporates every part of us. We feel it physically. We feel it energetically in the astral body. We feel it in our idea, our causal body. It stresses us in every possible way. Jesus has said, sweat blood, when he was in his the Garden of Gethsemane. And as I've said before, I don't know how stressful you have to get before you actually start sweating blood, but it sounds pretty intense. Pretty intense. And so these things are not easy. They're not easy. And as we go upward, we start at the heart chakra because that's the first chakra of transcendence. We go beyond the pure human concerns. And yet we're tempted by the draw and the pull of all the lower chakras, that of survival, that of sexual energy, that of individual control and power. And we struggle with each one of these. And the higher we go up, almost, the more deeply it delves into these lower chakras. They have to be completely purified. One of Papa's great challenges was with anger. And he described a situation in which he was walking down a path and the fit of anger came over him so greatly that he just fell down into the dirt. And he was just swimming in that dirt with this rage, with this anger that was coming out of him. And so we feel these things. These are not small things. These reach into the very deepest natures of your psyche, which can scare people off. They feel afraid of that. They don't want to go there. And yet, as Ananda Moyama said, the longer you avoid it, the more you delay that time when you will go through those experiences that are required in order for you to get your complete liberation and freedom. And I might add that the more time that goes on, the more you build up in ignorance, the various levels of ignorance you have, you will have to meet. So if you're creating new ignorance, you're only adding to the burden that you'll have when it comes to turning your life around and going completely into the state of realization. Now, Mother did not hold back in her descriptions of what she went through. And I thought she must have been the greatest salesperson in the entire world to talk about death, to talk about suffering, to talk about the hardships that she went through, and then to say, will you follow me? And who would do it? Who would do it? But those of us who have felt called to this higher life, to this inner life, to this life that goes beyond anything that we have known in the human sense, we will take that call willingly, gladly, because we know that on the other side of all of those experiences is the great birth into, as it is talked about metaphorically in the Bible, becoming a son of God. We transcend being a being a son of man, and become a son of God. And this is the greatest thing that we can achieve in this lifetime. It is a freedom, it is a bliss, it is a joy, it is an enlightening wisdom that is beyond all description. And if each one of us will take seriously this admonition by Ma and by Master, by our own dear beloved Guru, Mother Hamilton, then we will achieve what is sometimes thought by many to be impossibility. We have an entire world telling us that this is not possible. Master once said that if he was faced with speaking the truth and doing what was right, and that the whole world should stand against him, the whole world should stand against him, but God within him told him that this is the right thing to do, that he would do what is right. This is quite a test. The entire world telling you you are wrong. But you know with everything inside of you, this is what God would have for you. These are the kinds of tests that come up to us. But one by one, as we cross each one of those barriers, those horizontal barriers, we leave them behind us broken, and they never need bother us ever again. And we find out in that spiritual birth of the Son of God that we find increasing freedom, joy, light, bliss, the everythingness of God. And we never ever look back and regret anything that we've done in order to achieve that kind of growth. So Master continues, every spiritual devotee who regularly and deeply meditates realizes that he is an emperor of a kingdom of peace, which he himself has won by battling the forces of restlessness. But before the empire has been fully secured, even a veteran warrior will find that he is subject to manifold outer and inner influences that strive to usurp the glorious realm. On such occasions, the spiritual conqueror must advance boldly. Any devotee who refuses to engage himself in a righteous conflict with the suddenly invading soldiers of disquietude and unmeditative moods will lose the strenuously gained, honorable, enviable, and unending joy of the soul. The yogi who strives scientifically to unite his soul with spirit through guru-given techniques of meditation realizes that the greatest dharma, or protective virtue of the soul, is ever new joy. In closing with a poem from Papa, life is for service. Life is for service and for sacrifice. Spare life and you clog it with pain and sorrow. Expand it like clouds in the sky and pour down the showers of joy and peace on all the world's creatures. Reveal the hidden beauty of human nature like the verdure on the hills and plains after the monsoon rains. Thus life be a potent power charged with goodness, kindness, and love. If you'll pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace. Bliss. Amen.